Via remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. Weeks after the U.S. presidential election, the transition from the Trump administration to U.S. President-elect Joe Biden is set to begin. After the General Services Administration, the federal agency that must sign off on presidential transitions, verified that Biden is the apparent winner of the November 3rd election. The GSA announcement came shortly after officials in the state of Michigan certified Biden as the winner in their state, making Trump's legal efforts to change the election outcome even more unlikely to succeed. President Trump, who had refused to concede the election, said Monday that he is directing his team to cooperate on the transition, but is vowing to keep up the fight. The move by the GSA clears the way for the start of the transition of the Trump administration and allows Biden to coordinate with federal agencies on plans for taking over on January the 20th. International rights groups are urging Ethiopian forces to prioritize the safety of civilians in the Tigray region Monday as a 72-hour deadline for regional forces to surrender approaches. On Sunday, the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed gave a 72-hour deadline to Tigrayans' forces to surrender or face a military offensive from the central government, escalating a weeks-long conflict that has left hundreds of people dead. The United Nations said Monday that more than 30,000 people so far have fled Tigray to neighboring Sudan and echoed calls to preserve the safety of civilians. Tensions have been building in the region since September 9th when Tigray finally held a regional election. For more news, join us, voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. The Australian airline company Qantas says it will require international travelers in the future to prove they have been vaccinated against COVID-19 in order to fly, as another pharmaceutical company announced its progress in creating a potential vaccine to fight the virus. The comments come as AstraZeneca said Monday that clinical trials of its COVID-19 vaccine in Britain and Brazil have shown it is highly effective in preventing COVID-19 without hospitalizations or severe cases of the disease in any of the trial's volunteers. The United States continues to lead the world in infections with more than 12 million cases, followed by India with more than 9 million infections and Brazil with 6. The virus has claimed nearly 1.4 million lives so far. More than a quarter of a million of those deaths occurred here in the United States. Iranian forces continue to expand their military presence in parts of eastern Syria, a move analysts say that could undermine U.S.-led efforts in the fight against the remnants of the Islamic State terror group. Iran, a major backer of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's regime, controls parts of the eastern Deir el-Zor province, particularly areas along the border with Iraq. With the help of thousands of foreign and local militiamen, Iran's elite Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps has consolidated its hold over a large territory in Syria since the beginning of the country's civil war in 2011. Well, state authorities in Brazil announced on Monday that they have started the clinical trial studies for the Chinese-made CoronaVac vaccine. The study has reached the minimum number of volunteers who tested positive for COVID-19, and now they are able to check if the infected were those who received the vaccine or the placebo, which will determine its efficacy. CoronaVac is a partnership between the Sao Paulo State Institute for Biological Research in Butantan and the Chinese company Sinovac, and has been widely tested in Brazil. A day earlier, the federal government signed a letter of intent to purchase 5 COVID-19 vaccines without including CoronaVac. A landslide in Colombia struck a bar, killing 7 people, injuring more than a dozen others. In addition to those already confirmed dead or injured, local media reports say 15 other people may be missing. According to local authorities, the bar was operating illegally after midnight Monday when that landslide occurred. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There are calls to double international engagement and de-escalate Ethiopia-Tigray conflict.
Hopefully the lesson that's being learned is that the way that the government has pushed this the last 2.5 years hasn't brought everyone along, and that they need to rewind a bit to bring more parties in and to come up with a political solution rather than focusing on security.
The refugee agency sounds the alarm for an unfolding humanitarian crisis in Ethiopia. Could a Russian naval base at Port Sudan complicate U.S.-Sudanese relations? France is at odds with Mali's plan to dialogue with jihadists. Sierra Leone's former president sits down for an alleged corruption-related interview. And police brutality protest activists are suing Nigerian authorities for freezing their bank accounts.
So many people that they freeze their accounts, they can't run their businesses and all that. But what keeps us going is our shared determination that we'll see this through and would continue to push for an end to all forms of police brutality.
The Nigerian authorities have launched an investigation into Sunday's killing of at least 5 soldiers by Boko Haram militants. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An analyst says the international community must double its efforts towards de-escalating the military conflict between the Ethiopian federal government and its northern Tigray region. Jason Mosley, senior associate researcher for the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, says the international community should focus on bringing the parties together for dialogue toward a political solution because a military solution is not deliverable. His comments come as Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Monday gave Tigrayan regional forces 72 hours to surrender and avert a military offensive on the regional capital of Mekelle. Mosley says he doesn't think the surrender ultimatum will succeed.
This is the second time the Ethiopian federal government has given the leadership of the Tigrayan administration 72 hours to surrender. And I don't think it will be any more successful than the previous attempt to get the regional leadership to surrender. Both sides have pretty firmly entrenched their positions.
The African Union, United Nations are all saying there should be some negotiation. Do you think there can be any way out of this other than a military solution?
My own feeling is that there is no military solution to this situation. The crisis between the TPLF, the leadership of the Tigray region, and the Ethiopian federal government under Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed did not come suddenly out of nowhere. This has been building up more than a couple of years since Abiy Ahmed came to power in early 2018. And it's not the only instance of violent resistance to the agenda of the prime minister or other violence that the government under Abiy Ahmed has not been able to bring under control over the last couple of years. And so what I'm hoping is that the government and all the belligerent actors will look at the situation, the humanitarian catastrophe that's emerging, the fact that the Ethiopian military is not going to be able to swiftly impose a military solution, and listen to the calls from the African Union, from regional leaders around Ethiopia, their neighbors. The United Arab Emirates yesterday also added its voice to this. Other sort of external partners of Ethiopia, key bilateral donors and other partners in calling for a political solution. I think what needs to be drawn from what's been happening in the last few weeks is that the track that Abiy's been driving the Ethiopian state down the last couple of years hasn't brought everyone on board. He came to power on the back of a political crisis. And hopefully the lesson that's being learned is that the way that the government has pushed this the last 2.5 years hasn't brought everyone along, and that they need to rewind a bit, maybe back to 2018, when there was a lot of calls for a national dialogue to bring more parties in and to come up with a political solution rather than focusing on security. And I think focus probably should be shifting towards the international efforts to de-escalate the situation and bring all the parties and the other groups which oppose the Ethiopian government into more of a dialogue.
The Tigrayan government, or the people of Tigray, are saying that their region has been marginalized, but the Ethiopian federal government, Prime Minister Abiy, saying that his government is only trying to put down terrorism. For our listeners, what do you make of the origin of this crisis?
This crisis, as I said a moment ago, definitely has deeper roots than a sort of very recent outbreak of violence, or even the very recent dispute over the postponement of this year's elections. Really, the roots of this go back to the crisis that came from the large popular protest movements from 2014-15 up until 2018 when Abiy Ahmed came in. Those really challenged the previous administration, which was dominated by the TPLF, but included other actors, including Abiy Ahmed. That government really struggled to deal with this popular backlash that despite the headline growth and economic development, it wasn't delivering enough for enough people to keep them on board with the limited levels of political freedom that were on display under the EPRDF. There weren't enough economic opportunities to sort of justify the tight political control that the previous administration under the EPRDF had. When Abiy came in, he took some of that momentum and started transforming the political vehicle that dominates all levels of the Ethiopian government, from regional parties in each part of Ethiopia's federation in a coalition into a single party, the Prosperity Party, which he leads. The TPLF wasn't interested in dissolving the TPLF as a regional party and merging it into this new Prosperity Party. So when Abiy pushed that agenda into fruition a year ago, that really set things in motion to the crisis that we're seeing today.
Thank you so much, Mr. Mosley, for speaking with us.
My pleasure, and thanks for calling.
Jason Mosley is Senior Associate Researcher for the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. He was speaking with us from Stockholm. Refugee International says the situation in Ethiopia's Tigray region has all the hallmarks of a major humanitarian crisis in the making. In a new report entitled Caught in the Crossfire, Averting Further Humanitarian Disaster in Ethiopia, the group says if hostilities continue unabated, the shock waves of the emergency will be felt throughout the Horn of Africa and have global implications. Sarah Miller is a senior fellow with Refugees International.
It's really worrisome, and it's getting worse and worse. We're afraid that displacement is rising at really quick rates. There are already an estimated 38,000 that have fled into Sudan. Many, many more have been displaced internally from the Tigray region. And the Tigray region already hosted a large number of refugees itself, so we worry that they are not only not receiving assistance, but going to be displaced again. So it's a very worrisome situation. Large numbers of people displaced. Humanitarian actors are not able to access them. They don't have access to very much fuel. Food, medical supplies are all in very short supply. And, of course, communications have been cut, so it's very hard to get information. The situation is very serious, and we're worried that it's only going to get worse as the conflict intensifies.
Are you able to get direct access to the refugees?
So most aid groups are not having access to the displaced people in Tigray. In Sudan, there are aid groups mobilizing. So the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees is along the border where refugees are flowing into Sudan. But it's a very difficult area to access. Many of the roads were poor to begin with and have been washed out. So the UN is very limited in how well they can respond to those coming in. Other non-governmental organizations and groups are slowly starting to mobilize, but at upwards of 4,000 or 5,000 people a day coming in, this very remote region of Sudan is really struggling to keep up.
Of course, I'm sure you're aware that the Ethiopian Prime Minister had given 72 hours to the Tigrayan authorities to surrender. What kind of solution would your organization like to come out of this so as to gain direct access to the refugees?
So I think the first thing that needs to happen is a ceasefire. So, of course, this potential attack on Mekelle in the next 72 hours could be devastating. Much of the region, of course, was rural, but this is an urban population, so the displacement and devastation could be great. So the first thing that needs to happen is a ceasefire. The second thing would be restoring communication and giving access to humanitarian aid groups from the UN and other actors trying to access civilians who are desperately in need. They need food, medical attention, fuel, and communications restored. Those would be some of the most important things.
Sarah, we appreciate very much speaking with you, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Sarah Miller is Senior Fellow with Refugees International. She was speaking with us from Chicago, Illinois. Russia says it has an agreement with Sudan to build a naval base on Sudan's Red Sea coast, which will be Moscow's first military base in Africa. Analysts believe the deal could complicate Sudan's efforts to improve relations with the United States. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
According to the Russian statement, Sudan agreed to give Moscow a renewable 25-year pact for a naval base to be built north of Port Sudan on the Red Sea. Russian President Vladimir Putin said he ordered his defense minister to sign the pact. Russia reached the agreement in 2017 with the Sudanese government led by ousted President Omar al-Bashir. An official of the current government confirmed the agreement to VOA, but publicly, officials have said nothing about the Russian announcement. Analyst Mehdi Kanab explains the importance of the proposed facility. Kanab says Russian presence in the Red Sea is an attempt from Russia to have a footprint in Africa. He thinks it's a tactical goal, not a strategic one, to annoy the U.S. in one of its areas of influence and to balance the U.S. pressure on Russian influence areas like Syria and Libya specifically. The facility will have room for four ships, including nuclear-powered vessels, and house up to 300 sailors and base employees. Cameron Hudson, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center, thinks this pact could undermine U.S.-Sudanese relations.
This decision makes no sense. Sudan and the West are on the verge of a new chapter in their relations with a new set of allies that can assist Sudan's political transformation, its economic recovery, and its security. By allowing in a spoiler to gain a strategic foothold along the Red Sea undermines Sudan's turn towards the West and allows a powerful force into the country that could subvert the goals of the revolution.
Hudson also raised the prospect that the announcement could be Russian propaganda that Sudan is afraid to dispute or simply untrue. Sudan currently has a joint military-civilian government that took power in August of 2019. The new government has either canceled or revised some other agreements reached by the Bashir regime, including pacts with Turkey, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. In May 2019, military generals gave China approval to build a railway that links the port of Sudan with the Blue Nile state, a project with a budget of $3 billion. Analyst Kenneth believes Russia's agreement for a naval base is a sign of feverish Russian-Chinese competition for influence in Africa. Meanwhile, the United States' view on the Russian naval base remains unclear. Last month, the U.S. agreed to remove Sudan from its list of state sponsors of terrorism, a step that might allow Sudan to attract international investors and receive much-needed loans from institutions such as the World Bank. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 24th. The 8-year Islamist insurgency in the West African nation of Mali shows no sign of ending, and after an August coup toppled President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, the country's transitional government has indicated it is willing to open dialogue with all armed groups. From Paris, Nicolas Pinault says France, which has more than 5,000 troops in the country, has warned against any discussions with jihadists.
With terrorists, we do not discuss, we fight. The statement made recently by French President Emmanuel Macron in an interview is, to some analysts, a clear rebuke of the strategy initiated by transitional Malian authorities who are willing to open discussions with jihadists. Nicolas Normand is a former ambassador of France to Mali.
This is at odds with a desire of the Malian opinion to undertake a dialogue with Iyad Agali, Amadou Koufa. There is nothing to negotiate, actually, because the jihadist leaders do not ask for pardon or for reintegration in the Malian society. They want to impose a totalitarian regime. And, of course, Bamako resists against such a will. But I think the population is not really aware of what is at stake in their own liberty.
Following the signature of the so-called Algiers peace agreement, armed groups were supposed to join the national army. 5 years after the agreement, little progress has been made toward its implementation. According to Thierry Vircolo, a researcher with the French Institute of International Relations,
if the dialogue that the new authorities in Bamako wants to start is about the implementation of the Algiers Agreement, this is actually a very good development. So far, the Algiers Agreement, its implementation has been blocked by the previous Malian president who was really opposed to that agreement and didn't make any progress. The only way to make a progress in the Malian conflict is actually to implement this agreement.
Macron's comments about the dialogue contrast with the pro-French sentiment in Mali in early 2013, when French forces stopped jihadists from going to seize Bamako, the capital. Nicolas Normand says Macron's remarks show a growing gap between the Malian population and the former colonial power.
In 2013, when the French army intervened in Mali to combat the armed groups, they supported the separatists and they fought only against the jihadists. After 8 years, there is no real improvement in the security situation, despite many jihadists killed. 8 years is too long for the army of the former colonial power to stay in the country. The population does not understand.
Macron also said he will make decisions in the coming months on how to develop the French force, known as Barkhane, in the Sahel. With more than 50 French troops killed and little progress to report since the deployment, observers say France is considering pulling back its forces and encouraging other European nations to commit more forces to the region. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
Former Sierra Leone President Ernest Bai Koroma has made his long-awaited appearance before the country's Anti-Corruption Commission for an interview related to allegations of corruption during his presidency from 2007 to 2018. The interview, originally scheduled to take place October 5th, was moved twice at the request of the former president because of safety concerns. Last week, the commission threatened to arrest Mr. Koroma for failure to appear. Patrick Sandy is the director of communication and outreach for the Sierra Leone Anti-Corruption Commission.
The former president, Dr. Ernest Bai Koroma, today was interviewed by the Anti-Corruption Commission investigators. The interview, members of the public, we understand, had long been awaited. We had made initial arrangements for it to hold twice, but it did not. But yes, today we commenced and we will continue.
Where did the interview take place? At the former president's residence?
The interview took place at an undisclosed location in a secured safe house. It did not take place at the former president's residence.
With the former president appearing, does this avert the threat that your commission made of a possible arrest? Does this now put it to rest?
Yes, the fact that the president showed up today and they were able to interview him means that the aspect of the warrant of arrest no longer exists, because he showed up and we are thankful that he came. And of course, the message we had sent out was that if the 23rd of November elapses, which is this Monday, then the commission will move ahead in that direction. And I must state that the commissioner was determined to have gone in that direction.
So do we know when next will the former president appear again?
The ACC and the former president lawyers agreed on a date for the next interview.
Patrick Sandy is the Director of Communication and Outreach of the Sierra Leone Anti-Corruption Commission. He was speaking with us from the capital of Freetown. Prominent Nigerian activists who took part in nationwide weeks-long protests against police brutality are suing authorities for freezing their bank accounts. The Central Bank of Nigeria, under a court order, froze accounts belonging to 20 members of the End SARS movement, saying they were used to instigate acts of terror. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Nigerian human rights lawyer Marshall Abubakar, who represents the activists, says they are expecting to be invited to a hearing this week on the frozen bank accounts. According to Nigerian law, he says the defendants should have been given a hearing by November 18, 2 weeks from when the court order was issued. The Central Bank of Nigeria said the court ordered a 90-day freeze on the accounts for alleged links to funding terrorism. The activists say they only funded protests against police brutality and that the accounts were frozen in October, weeks before the court issued the order. Abubakar notes taking restrictive financial measures against protesters before obtaining a court order is illegal.
The order, which was sought and obtained from the Federal High Court Abuja Division, was actually obtained to validate an unlawful act that had already taken place. They've been denied the right to engage in business. the right to get money to feed themselves and pay their bills.
Activists say the suspension of funds meant to support the NSAR's movement against police brutality is clearly political. Nigerian activist and brand strategist Renu Odwala, whose account was among those frozen, says it has also affected her ability to run her business.
So many people that they freeze their accounts, they can't run their businesses and all that. But what keeps us going is our shared determination that we'll see this through and we'll get justice for victims, and that would continue to push for an end to all forms of police brutality.
The NSAR's activists say the accounts received donations to provide food, medical care, and legal support to protesters. Activist Idunu Williams, whose account was also frozen, says many victims couldn't receive help after the funds were cut off.
This is very irritating, to be very honest. Like, we're trying to make a better country for ourselves, and all the institutions that are supposed to back us up are the ones that are actually bullying us and literally trying to suppress us every single day. They called us criminals, they called us terrorists because we said we don't want Nigeria to spoil before our very eyes.
Nigeria's government spokespeople and the Central Bank of Nigeria refused to comment on the issue. The NSAR's protests began in October, calling for the disbanding of Nigeria's notoriously brutal special anti-robbery squad, SARS. Authorities gave in to the demand, only to see protesters expand their demonstrations and call for better governance. As the protests spread, on October 20, the military opened fire in Lagos and, according to Amnesty International, left at least 10 people dead. A Nigerian army commander on Saturday admitted that troops had live ammunition when sent to quell the protests, but insisted they only fired blanks in the air. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Nigerian authorities have launched an investigation into Sunday's killing of at least 5 soldiers and a civilian in an ambush by suspected Boko Haram militants in the northern city of Maiduguri. Residents report more troops have arrived in the city to beef up security. VOA's Chinedu Ofor spoke to analyst Mohamed Sani, who says the city is tense but calm.
People have developed a kind of resilience. They are used to whatever, you know, challenges, you know, that have been held against them by the insurgency. They have now known that these terrorists are enemies, not just of the government, but of their collective existence.
Is the military explaining such brazen attack almost in the heart of the city, despite assurances that the terrorists are on the run?
They have a very vibrant CCM, that is Civil Military Affairs Unit. They are doing their best to enlighten the local populace, you know, on the challenges confronting not just Borno, but the country as a whole. So the local populace are being made to understand that the army, the military in general, is on top of the situation. There is no way they can perform magic. There is no way they can, you know, do successful operations if local populace don't provide credible intelligence.
So are there reinforcements, military reinforcements?
We've seen a joint operation between the army, the military in general, under Operation Lafia Dole, currently carrying out operations against the insurgents.
That was analyst Mohamed Sani speaking with viewers Chinedu Ofor from Maiduguri, northern Nigeria. And that's it for this Tuesday, November 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you will have a great week.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.